Hello, and welcome to the latest in our Axial Spondyloarthritis podcast series. We'll be bringing you new episodes on a monthly basis alongside our RA and PSA podcasts, and we'll also be supplying you with monthly slide decks to help keep you up to date with the latest research and publications in the field of Axial SpA. My name is Sofia Ramiro. I'm a consultant rheumatologist and senior researcher at Leiden University Medical Center and at Zuiderland Medical Center. And today with me, we have here Hideto Kameda, Professor of Internal Medicine at Toho University, and Professor Atul Deodar, a Professor of Medicine and Medical Director of Rheumatology Clinics and the Division of Arthritis and Rheumatic Diseases at Oregon Health Science University in Portland. We are also joined by Professor Xenophon Baraliakos, Professor of Internal Medicine and Rheumatology at the Ruhr University in Bochum and Medical Director of the Rheumatology Center, Rheumatzentrum Ruhrgebiet in Herne, Germany. And of course, if you want to find out more about us and the papers we discussed today, please head over to the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum website, www.imidforum.com. So over to you, Hideto.
Hey, thank you, Sophia. In the first paper we will discuss today, the authors compared the risk of acute anterior uveitis across different biological edemas in patients with ankylosing spondylitis or radiographic axial SpA. Following on from this, we'll discuss our second publication where investigators compared patient-reported outcomes and 24-month retention rates between patients with axial SpA and psoriatic arthritis that were treated with secukinumab. Over to you, Xenophon.
Thank you very much, Hideto. Our first paper is titled Comparative Risk of Incident and Recurrent Acute Anterior Uveitis Across Different Biological Agents in Patients with Ankylosing Spondylitis. It's authored by Kwon and colleagues. To the study background, acute anterior uveitis is the most common extramusculoskeletal manifestation of ankylosing spondylitis. Data on comparative risk of incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis according to different BEDMATs in patients with ankylosing spondylitis are limited, and the objective of this study now was to evaluate the comparative risk of incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis across different BEDMATs in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. For the methods, patient data from the years 2010 to 2021 were collected from the South Korean Health Insurance Review and Assessment Service database. These patients were diagnosed with ankylosing spondylitis after 2010. They had no exposure to medication prior to the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis. They did not have a diagnosis of acute anterior uveitis prior to the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis, and they were diagnosed with acute anterior uveitis now. This means 3 months or longer after the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis. The patient's treatments were split into three categories: BEDMAT non-exposure, TNF exposure. This includes adalimumab, etanercept, golimumab, and infliximab, and exposure to IL-17 inhibitors. This means secukinumab and ixekizumab. And the incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis rates were assessed as the study outcomes, and this will be reported. So what did the colleagues find? They, first of all, they had 34,621 patients. This means more than 34,000 patients, and their data were pulled. All patients contributed person years to the BEDMAT non-exposure group. About 10,926 contributed to the TNF blockers, and around 350, this means 348 to be concrete, contributed to the IL-17 inhibitor group. The incidence rates were highest in patients treated with etanercept, and they were significantly higher than the biologic DMARD non-exposure. Incidence of acute anterior uveitis was lowest for adalimumab and golimumab. No events of acute anterior uveitis were recorded for ixekizumab, so it was excluded from the further for any further analysis. Both adalimumab and golimumab exposure were associated with a lower risk of incident acute anterior uveitis when compared to the BD-MAT non-exposure. Adalimumab exposure was also associated with lower risk of recurrent acute anterior uveitis than BD-MAT non-exposure, whereas etanercept exposure was associated with a higher risk of recurrent acute anterior uveitis. This is a lot of data, but in order to conclude, adalimumab, at least according to this study, was significantly reducing the risk of new episodes, this means incidents or recurrent acute anterior uveitis versus etanercept exposure, and also versus BD-MAT non-exposure. Exposure to etanercept significantly increased the risk of incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis versus patients who were not exposed to BD-MATs. Golimumab, on the other hand, had a significantly reduced risk of incident acute anterior uveitis versus BD-MAT non-exposure. Infliximab and secukinumab had no significant effect on incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis. So altogether, we see that there might, first of all, we have differences between the biologic DMARDs in terms of new onsets or flares of uveitis, both within the TNF progress, but also based or in comparison to a biologic DMARD non-exposure. That's overall the paper. It's open for discussion now between us, and I would like to hear your opinion.
Thank you very much, Xenophon. I think this was a very good presentation of this study. And as you were mentioning, indeed, it's very important to have this comparative data on the effect of the different biologics from which we know there are differences on the occurrence of the flares of uveitis. First of all, I think it's reassuring to see in overall line that these data are in accordance to data that we have seen before and that we have actually used to base on the most recent Azazula recommendations. So indeed, with monoclonal antibodies against TNF, we seem to see a lower occurrence of uveitis than that we also saw here. I think two particularities that this study has, one of them is the fact that they also compare to the so the different biologics to non-BD-MARD exposure, and I think it's interesting to see that, which exactly are the biologics that are associated with a lower rate of uveitis compared to non-BD-MARD exposure versus, for example, infliximab and secukinumab, for which there were no differences seen. On the other hand, it's also interesting to see that, well, we have more data in the literature on the occurrence of uveitis, a little bit less with IL-17 inhibitors. And the study that has IL-17 inhibitors only had included secukinumab. So in this study, we have ixekizumab. That's the good sign or the good news. On the other hand, there were no uveitis at all with ixekizumab, so it had to be removed from the analysis. The question is, does ixekizumab have a different profile in terms of the occurrence of uveitis compared to, for example, secukinumab, and therefore there were less uveitis episodes, or simply it's a power problem because there were few cases with IL-17 inhibition included in this study and therefore also few cases with ixekizumab? So happy to hear everyone's thoughts on this.
Yeah,
thank you.
Go ahead. Okay, thank you. So I'm very interested in this paper. And first, I want to point out that in last ACL, uveitis rates was with bimekizumab was reduced when we analyze the BMobile 1 and 2 as compared with placebo. So it was go forward with ixekizumab and different from secukinumab data. So I want to know the difference between IL-70A inhibitor or IL-70A and F inhibitor, or we need much more examinations or results.
I'm happy to take that up. Atul, did you want to comment on this? Otherwise, I can.
So I agree with both the comments. Hideto's comment is about bimekizumab, and I'll come to that in a minute. I was surprised with this paper in a couple of things. Number one is, overall, it kind of fits with what we know is that monoclonal antibodies are better in preventing recurrence or reducing incidence of acute anterior uveitis in patients with ankylosing spondylitis. The first thing is, these types of papers, when they are done on insurance claims database, how sure were they about the diagnosis of ankylosing spondylitis and also acute anterior uveitis? Was it diagnosed by the AAU diagnosis, which is entered there? Was it done by ophthalmologist or not? I mean, this is not kind of a database that all of us participate in. This is from insurance claims database. So the diagnosis always makes me a little bit nervous. Now, I know a little bit about Korean health insurance system in that you will not get a biologic in Korea for treating ankylosing spondylitis unless you, in fact, submit a report of the radiologist showing that there is bilateral sacroiliitis and it meets modified New York criteria. So that's pretty strict. So I would be, I'm willing to believe that these people had AS. I'm not so sure whether they really had AAU or not, because I don't know whether that diagnosis was made by a rheumatologist who's treating them or whether it was ophthalmologist. But the reason I'm bringing this is, what is surprising is the incidence of uveitis in patients treated with etanercept is higher than those who were biologic demand non-exposure. There is a channeling bias, number one, I think. Patients who receive biologic demands probably had worse ankylosing spondylitis or other things happening, and that's why they were chosen to receive biologic demand as opposed to those who never got biologic demand. So there is a channeling bias. But I am not so sure that that is my experience. Etanercept is not as effective as monoclonal antibodies, but it is not a risk factor for getting people more acute anterior uveitis. In our experience, and we have a large group of patients with uveitis, we think that etanercept is effective in treatment, or actually in prevention of acute anterior uveitis, not as effective as biologic demand. And the same thing with secukinumab. It is Jim Rosenbaum, who I used to work with, he's a big uveitis specialist. He used to say that etanercept is as effective as sulfasalazine in prevention of acute anterior uveitis. And sulfasalazine there is some efficacy in prevention of new attacks of uveitis. And the second odd thing about this paper is infliximab. Infliximab showed no difference, significant effect, which is also astounding to me. I mean, infliximab is extraordinarily useful. Several reports have shown that it is very effective. Secukinumab, I understand. And so always when there is a paper published that doesn't really go along with what our experience is, we are trying to find out some reasons behind that. And so I just wanted to throw it out there for you guys. I mean, what do you think? I mean, are there channeling bias here, the patients who received these drugs, etc.?
I could not agree more with you at all. And I'm actually happy that you brought this up. I'm usually the critical voice of methodological aspects. So I thought today I would start with the positive comments. And I'm glad you mentioned exactly, I could not agree more with you. Indeed, I think from claims data sets, it's good to have results. They are powerful in terms of numbers. But I think we have to interpret them with caution, especially in terms of what you mentioned, in terms of the definition of the diagnosis and also of the exposure, in this case, also the definition of the outcome, uveitis. And I also share the same doubts and questions and surprise about what you mentioned. I agree that etanercept is more efficacious. That's also what we know is less efficacious, in preventing flares than other monoclonal antibody drugs, but right. It's not my experience that it's a risk factor, not at all. And it makes sense that it suppresses inflammation. And the same happens for secukinumab. So it seems to be less efficacious than other drugs, but I don't think that it's less efficacious than non-BDMART exposure. So I share the same concerns as you.
Just a quick thing about what Hideto was saying, and it's true that the IL-17A plus IL-17F inhibitor bimekizumab does look different than just IL-17A, pure IL-17A inhibitors. And they have looked at now their phase 2 study, their pooled phase 2 and phase 3 study, and separately only phase 3 studies. They had two phase 3 studies, one phase 2 study. They pooled it and all kinds of combinations, etc. That paper is in publication with RMD Open. That will come out soon. But I agree with Hideto that somehow IL-17F combined inhibition of IL-17F with IL-17A inhibition does seem to reduce the risk of, well, reduces incident and recurrent acute anterior uveitis. One another thing quickly is they don't have sertolizumab as one of the monoclonal antibodies, TNF inhibitor, and sertolizumab has published data showing that they actually did a separate study called C-View, C as in the letter ABC-View, and that was, and they specifically took patients with axial spondyloarthritis, non-radiographic and radiographic, who had a history of uveitis in the last year, the past year. History of uveitis in the year before is a risk factor for new onset of uveitis. So they had kind of enriched their data set with patients who are likely to get uveitis in the next year. And those are the people who were given sertolizumab. And then they compared the incident rates of acute anterior uveitis ophthalmology proved or ophthalmology assessed in that year and compared them with before the patients received sertolizumab, and they showed that there is a difference. I mean, this is an interesting study design, but that study has been published. So that just goes along with our idea that these monoclonal antibodies do prevent recurrence. Sorry, Xenophon, you were saying something, and I...
No, I think you've said everything. We can certainly discuss very long about this paper. Partly goes along with what we know from the literature. I agree with the methodological concerns. On the other hand, I can also add here that if that concern is applying to the one drug, it's applying to the other as well. So if there is a bias, it's for all for the entire group, which equalizes it a little bit, but still, of course, you never know how things have been coded. And hence, these results may not be what is really happening, but what's rather happening, or let's say being coded for any reason. But that's fine. I think we discussed that paper pretty long now, and I understand that this is interesting also for daily practice at some point or somehow.
Yes. And another my concern is the co-medication, because in this study, 82% of patients received glucocorticoids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But diagnosis is actual SPA. So it is kind of odd, right? So such kind of co-medication or tapering of glucocorticoid after starting the biological edemas may affect the results. That is my concern.
And I think that is not our daily clinical practice. And so I think it's important to emphasize that that is not how we are used to treating actual SPA. So there may be differences. I think it's a very valid point.
Yep.
Yes.
Shall we go to the second paper?
Yeah, yes, thanks. So thanks, Sophia. So so over to our second paper titled Patient-Reported Outcomes in Axial Spondyloarthritis and Psoriatic Arthritis, Patients Treated with Secukinumab for 24 Months in Daily Clinical Practice. This is authored by Christensen et al. And the background of this study is that patient-reported outcomes such as pain and fatigue are important, most important from the patient's point of view, and they are key measures in evaluation of rheumatic diseases in our daily clinical practice. I mean, that's what the patient reports us when they show up in the clinic. Secukinumab is a IL-17A inhibitor, which is approved for the treatment of non-radiographic and radiographic axial spondyloarthritis and psoriatic arthritis. And data are available on PROs from multiple randomized clinical trials. This study aimed to assess and compare the 6-month, 12-month, and 24-month PROs, patient-reported outcomes, in axial SPA and psoriatic arthritis patients treated by secukinumab, as well as the 24 monthly retention rates from registries. So this is a real-life experience. So they selected 16 Eurospar registries from different countries. And these are patients being followed in clinical practice in Europe and put into registries. And they had baseline patient and disease characteristics that were extracted. PROs were assessed at month 6, 12, and 24. And then they define remission and retention rates. Well, so remission is defined as pain less than 2 on a scale of 0 to 10, fatigue less than 2, 0 to 10, and patient global assessment remission was also less than 2 on a scale, less than or equal to 2, I should say. So pain, fatigue, and patient global assessment less than or equal to 2 on a scale of 0 to 10, and HAC less than 0.5. So I went back and again reread it again and again, this paper, but I couldn't find out, is this remission at only one time at 6 months or 12 months or any one time or all three times, 6, 12, and 24? Because I always stumble when it comes to remission. I can say that somebody is in low disease activity or inactive disease that particular moment when they're sitting in front of me. But as you all know, in practice, patients say that, oh, doc, I'm doing great today, but last week I was really bad. So, I mean, then that's not really a remission. Anyhow, they don't really say what remission is in the actual paper, apart from saying that they don't say how many times this has to be successfully fulfilled. So they had 3,087 patients with axial SPA and 3,246 with psoriatic arthritis. They had comparable baseline disease activity and PROs across both the groups. Axial SPA patients showed higher unadjusted PRO remission rates and greater absolute change in pain, fatigue, and PGA score compared to psoriatic arthritis patient after 24 months. Now, this is unadjusted. But when they adjusted the baseline characteristics and even for the biologic treatments that the patients that they were receiving, the remission rates were very similar. When they saw within the same amount of time, there was no significant difference in pain, PGA, and HAC remission rates when they adjusted for these baseline characteristics and especially for the treatment they received. The adjusted fatigue remission rates were numerically higher in patients with axial SPA than PSA. And absolute changes in the patient-reported outcomes were higher in axial SPA patients compared to psoriatic arthritis for pain, fatigue, and PGA. And changes in the HAC score were similar between the two patient groups. So their conclusion is that the while the randomized clinical trial data indicated higher efficacy as measured by PROs in axial SPA patient compared to psoriatic arthritis patients, this actually, when they adjusted for those baseline characteristics, it was pretty similar. That secukinumab seems to affect, in a good way, the patient-reported outcomes in axial SPA and PSA. And secukinumab, so this was kind of comparable when adjusted for confounders. And I, one of the things after reading this is I didn't know why they were really trying to compare between axial SPA and PSA. It doesn't really matter. I mean, the drug is useful, approved for both conditions. So I'll open it for your thoughts.
Maybe I can start. Thank you very much, Atul, for this very nice presentation of this paper. I have some thoughts that, from the way you commented on them, I think we are again in agreement. First, in terms of what is really the added value of comparing the two diseases, and in the conclusion you were mentioning that RCT data indicated higher efficacy in actual SPA compared to PSA patients, but I'm even surprised that about what exactly that means. Intriguing, because RCTs, there's no RCT comparing both diseases. So all those type of comparisons are always very indirect, very imprecise, and with a lot of limitations. That is my comment, first comment. The second, and before you this time have the chance of making extensive comments on methodological limitations, I would like to already state one, which is, these are known registries with a lot of patients, and we see that they have included roughly above 3,000 axSpA patients and PSA patients. I think we will all recognize that this is far under the number of patients that are included in these registries. And this is, for me, often the type of problem in this type of registry, especially this collaboration of registries that are different and are tried to, the analysis are combined or are conducted in merged data sets. And then there are a lot of missing data. And because of the lot of missing data, then only very few patients can be included compared to the total of patients that are included in the original data sets. And that poses questions about potential selection bias. In the end, there's a big strength of cohort studies and registries is being representative of daily clinical practice. But if we are extracting a small proportion of them because those are the patients with complete data that could be analyzed, then we don't know to what extent they are representative of daily clinical practice. And I think that is, of course, the challenge of trying to have these collaborative issues across different data sets, but of course have their value, but I wanted to share this point with all of you. So what do you think, Ivetto, about the paper and what?
Yeah, I would like to also ask the colleagues about what do they think is the definition of remission as opposed to inactive disease?
Yeah. I think we have a bit of silence first.
Yeah, but we need some time frame, like 3 months or 6 months or 1 year. So kind of sustained remission is true remission, not just one time point.
One time point, exactly. And so they don't really say that in the paper as to what do they mean. They use the word remission. And another point that you raised, Sophia, is important, that they had lots of missing data. They talk about that what do they do when there is missing data, and they say that, and even this, not every registry or not, but these are real life situations in clinical practice in these several European countries. It's not that the patients are seen at exactly 6 months, 12 months and 24 months. They kind of took it as that 6 months is kind of goes from 4 months to 8 months, and the 12 months goes from again 8 months to 15 months. And they tried to take it as close to that number as possible. That was number one. And number two, several of those, they said that we in fact chose the data point where maximum PROs were available. So suppose somebody actually came at 12 months, but they did not have fatigue measured or the patient global assessment or HAQ was not measured. Whereas one time point in 24 months, they actually had everything measured. So then they use 24 months because at least they have got all the PROs. So you're absolutely right that there are this is what happens in real life practice when you're busy and you're also the patient is in the registry, but you are actually trying to see more patients and you're trying to finish your clinic. A patient may or may not complete all the data. These are not randomized controlled trials. There is the amount of data that you can collect, there is a limitation. And that then reflects into when you are trying to extract the data and trying to get something out of it, then you find, oh, they haven't completed this at this visit. Maybe we should drop that visit. Oh, this is not exactly at this time point. We will make an exception. So you are spot on, Sophia, that these are problems. There are advantages of having such large number of patients, but the disadvantages are these, that they may not be very accurate.
I just want to introduce the recent French national database results, and I try to identify the difficult to treat axial spondylitis associated factors. And they found that female sex peripheral symptoms, psoriasis, depression, and hypertension were the factors associated with difficult to treat axial spondyloarthritis. So this makes some difference between axial spondyloarthritis and psoriatic arthritis, but this study is only using the secukinumab data, so we don't know.
Yeah,
well, valid points indeed.
In fact, this my comment was actually about to going to the same way. What's the differences between the diseases? There might be some. Yeah, there might be some. On the other hand, and I agree with everybody else before, the drug is not addressing them. Yeah. So it's a little bit of you have different conditions, but you then try to check what the drug is doing, which is not affecting those differences. I'm also a little bit struggling with this data, to be honest. What I have learned out of this paper is that there are issues, especially in the PROs, but we see them in those diseases similarly partly. Fatigue has been one of them, and this is a different kind of situation that you do not address with IL-17 inhibitors. And otherwise, we need to pay attention to the methodological issues, absolutely, in these kind of studies.
Just one last point before we close is that, and I make this point in my lectures also, that measuring something is important. You should be measuring, and PROs probably is the best way to measure. That actually puts the clinician on, you know, on their toes, that we are measuring it regularly and if the patient is worsening or not worsening, and just rather than just a gestalt. I mean, you can measure ASDAS, you can measure BASDAI, you can measure RAPID3, you can measure something, HAQ. But if you measure it regularly, it definitely helps the patient. It improves the quality of your daily clinical practice. And we have got so many amazing new drugs that we are also trying to get better and better at trying to achieve higher. I mean, this is less than 2 on a scale of 0 to 10 for pain and fatigue. And this is pretty strict. This is kind of like getting into fit to target situation here in active disease remission. And we may or may not get there, but at least you are trying to measure, and at least we are, it's aspirational goal. And that always helps the patient and always improves. This is the quality of our practice. And, so those who are listening, I'm just kind of making a plea, please measure. PROs are great to measure. Patient loves to, you know, and that's what they're talking about. They're not that interested about CRP-VR, but they're interested about their pain and fatigue and ability to work. So, all right, I'll stop there.
Totally agree, Atul. We can only change something if we measure it. Otherwise, we don't know what's going on. So I couldn't agree more. And this has been a very interesting and lively discussion, fortunately, as usual, but it's time to bring it to closure. So thank you all of you for joining us for this AxSpA podcast brought to you by the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum. We really hope you found it useful. And if you did, please don't forget to subscribe to our channels on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so that you don't miss any future episodes. If you want to read more about what we've discussed today, head over to the imedforum.com, where you'll find a summary of the slides of both papers. See you next time.